once you see that it's successful, because you can see how it started in El Salvador, how it's doing. Then you have Suriname next. Then you have we already have, you know, some other countries that are also looking at it, countries that are just buying it, countries that are investing or diversifying more into mining. So it's already spreading, but it will just be a more rapid way to actually show that government, the state, doesn't have to be the way it is right now, that the world doesn't have to be the way that it is right now. The world is in kind of like a whirlwind at the moment, or the whirlpool, like just kind of spiraling and spiraling and spiraling down. And we just need to have like one little boat that figures out a way to get up, and then the rest will follow. That is what I envision for this country, and what I hope that, you know, I can help build for my kids and my grandkids. A future that I would be proud of to bring kids into this world. So, yeah, that's what I'm dedicating the rest of my life toward.
Greetings and salutations, my fellow plebs. My name is Walker, and this is the Bitcoin Podcast. The Bitcoin time chain is 843589, and the value of one Bitcoin is still one Bitcoin. Today's episode is Bitcoin Talk, where I talk with my guest about Bitcoin and whatever else comes up. Today, that guest is Maya Padabu. Maya is a Bitcoiner and an entrepreneur, and she's currently running for president of Suriname. This conversation was really fascinating because even though Maya is running for political office, one of her main goals is to decrease the size of the state and the role of the government. Put another way, she's a Bitcoiner first and a politician second. If you're like me, you probably don't know a lot about Suriname, but after this episode, you definitely will. And I hope you see the incredible potential this country has under new leadership like Maya's and on a Bitcoin standard. I highly encourage you to follow Maya on Nostr and Twitter as she prepares for the 2025 elections in Suriname. You can find her links in the show notes. Before we dive in, do me a favor and subscribe to the Bitcoin Podcast wherever you're listening and give this show a 5-star rating. Or don't, Bitcoin doesn't care, but I sure would appreciate it. And just a heads up, you can find links in the show notes to get discounts on the Bitcoin-only Bitbox O2 hardware wallet from Bitbox and on 5G SIM cards from Cloaked Wireless that protect you from SIM swap attacks. The promo code for both is Walker. If you'd rather watch this show than listen, head to the show notes for links to watch on YouTube, Rumble, and now on Nostr via Highlighter. But if you're like me and you prefer to just listen to your podcasts, I highly recommend you check out Fountain.fm. Not only can you send Bitcoin to your favorite podcasters to give value for value, but you can earn Bitcoin just for listening to this show. And if you're already listening to the Bitcoin Podcast on Fountain, consider giving the show a boost or creating a clip of something you found interesting. Finally, if you are a Bitcoin-only company interested in sponsoring another fucking Bitcoin podcast, hit me up on social media or through the website bitcoinpodcast.net. Without further ado, let's get into this Bitcoin talk with Maya Padabu. How's it going? It's been since Prague, yeah.
Yeah, it's almost a year now, right?
That's wild. We had this, you know, this whole baby thing, and now it's like time's already strange in the Bitcoin space, and now it's just like even more strange.
Really?
So yeah, it feels like it was yesterday, but like now there's just like this little human alongside us too. So like very clearly showing us the passage of time.
Oh.
Well,
that is adorable.
You know, I've got to say also, you are definitely the first presidential candidate I have had on this show. So,
oh, interesting.
Yeah, I know it's shocking. I haven't interviewed tons of presidential candidates yet, but I'm very very honored that you would be the first one on here. So, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe a good place to start out, I think, is just for maybe for anyone who is not familiar with you, and just kind of to set the stage a little bit, I'd just like to ask a very open-ended question, and you can take it
whatever way you want to. But that's sure. just who are you and how did you get here today to be now running for president, which is quite an incredible thing to be doing for anyone.
Well, I'm an entrepreneur. I kind of, like my grandfather was, you know, in trade here in Suriname. My father after him, and then he passed away when I was 12. And we were kind of like, out of necessity, you know, my mom was working and I just kind of started working on the side. And I started an import-export company. And after that, I think about a decade ago, I started an infrastructure and civil engineering company. So that was the second one, which we bootstrapped and built over the last decade. And we do works primarily for the gold mining companies, oil companies, or ports, dams, dikes, channels, roads. So primarily infrastructure. And then I had already learned about Bitcoin. A friend told me about it in 2012. And then I started kind of following just how it was developing over time and, you know, building my businesses back then and trying to make, you know, pay the mortgage here at a 19% interest rate. And just, you know, struggling to build and scale those companies here in Suriname. And I was actually looking at, you know, the main problems we were facing as a country, just growing up, knowing about tech stocks and, you know, the U.S. capital market system and just seeing like companies raising capital to scale. And these were companies that were doing less revenue than some of the companies here in Suriname. And they're very well structured. Like it's most of us in executive positions here are Dutch educated. So they're very well structured and they, you know, they scale properly and like the financials could actually support a capital raise. And I like was just looking at problems that I myself was facing, you know, building those companies and what the economy was facing, what people like me were facing, trying to build, you know, just yourself, your family, by be able to afford shelter, get a mortgage and things like that. And then I saw that, you know, we didn't have a developed capital market here, similar to what, for example, you're so familiar with in the U.S., right? We don't have that here. So you're missing a portion of the economy, basically, where people are able to allocate resources to what is supposed to be the most, you know, productive sectors in society, but or in the market. So they're missing that aspect. And from you know, private sector side, then you're basically just missing risk capital. So you're solely dependent on the banks. And if interest percentages are very high here, which they are, then a lot of people are either priced out of the market or it makes competition and just being able to fairly compete very hard here, which limits innovation, you know, and change and growth of the country and the economy. So I started looking at the capital market. It was still early days in Bitcoin. I was in Whirlpool all the time talking and trying to convince them that Suriname would be great for Bitcoin adoption, specifically because of this reason. You know, Satoshi created Bitcoin because after the 2008 financial crisis, we don't have a capital market at all. So we can build it from scratch, you know, from the ground up, which is a unique opportunity using Bitcoin at its core. But the problem back then was how do you do that? You know, there was no Taproot, there was no Chaumian Mints, there was no federated protocol or anything back then. So it was still a bit hard to figure out. So we started on focusing on an exchange, you know, thinking that would be the sly roundabout way to increase Bitcoin adoption, but also use or build that capital market with Bitcoin at its core. Along that process, we've been working here with the central bank. There's a sandbox that's been established at the central bank. Fintech policy for the country was developed. And we've been in that process for such a long time that we just started to focus on, you know, creating a solution for the entire industry or, you know, more people than just Suriname. But using the struggles that we face here and the infrastructure that is available to build that foundation, because you don't have the legacy infrastructure you have in Western economies, right? So that can create a unique opportunity to innovate without that existing infrastructure, you know, kind of like even limiting the way you think, because you're so used to certain things just being there and being accessible and being easy that you don't realize what we have here and the issues that we face here, especially with the amount of people that are, you know, also still unbanked. It's still a cash-based economy. We have no online payment methods. You know, you can't just easily integrate anything to accept, you know, Visa or MasterCard. People that debit cards don't have Visa or Master on them. It's just a local card that you can only use here. So websites and, you know, online shopping never really took off here yet because it's just not there. And then you can use, you know, integrate Bitcoin as payment method. And now, like a tour guide, for example, he integrated it yesterday. And now he can accept payments from anywhere in the world. So that's basically my tumbling down the rabbit hole. I went to El Salvador in 2021 to try and kind of get to also lobby for Suriname. And out of that, or after that, actually came a conversation with, I think it was a friend of mine, Daniel. He sent me a link to 21.world. You know, I was asking, how do I get what's happened in El Salvador in Suriname? And then I started with 21.world that created the Dutch community. I've been just actually like trying to contribute as much as I can for the past year. And I was kind of bugging Samson to come to Suriname because I asked someone, I think it was Edwin. I asked him, you know, from of Gen 3, I asked him, how do I get adoption like El Salvador in Suriname? He says, convince Samson to get on a plane. So then I just basically, yeah, I put that, you know, that's the target. I need to convince Samson to come to Suriname. He needs to see this country. He needs to understand why, because you don't really get it until you've actually been here. I've had that with, because there are a bunch of Bitcoiners moving here now, and I've had it with a lot that I've traveled here to, that they get it when they're here. That's when they see like, oh, these people really need Bitcoin. Like this exchange rate it's annoying or exhausting the way it fluctuates. Unable to exchange, you know, SRD easily for a foreign currency. And just the way you need to transact, it's pretty stressful. And when you see people, you know, standing in lines at ATMs, when you hear what the interest rates is at a bank, you know, for a mortgage, now would be around 18-19%. So just imagine trying to build, you know, to buy a home for your family or build a future for your family, and that is what you need to pay annually in interest. And we've had a lot of issues with just government corruption, and I'd always been advocating against it. And being a political activist is never easy here, right? Like you're constantly like complaining about government, basically, or complaining about the central bank. Like the central bank did open market operations, something that I had also, you know, discussed with the governor then. But the whole point was to be able to, at least in some way, in the interim, be able to control the interest rates or be able to lower them, because they had just gotten the ability to buy U.S. treasuries. And then what they did is they now offer short-term bonds for 90%. It's gone down a little bit to 69%, but it's still the highest in the world. So you've had that. I've been very vocal about that, and I've been very vocal about corruption in the country. So that has given me a certain reputation here. I've been advocating for Bitcoin for over 6 years here. So I've spoken at the ICT conferences here. I've been on TV about it here. So everybody knows me as the Bitcoin lady.
I love it.
So that locally is already they already know that here. But basically, it created kind of a platform or a way for us to, you know, allow, for example, Samson to come here. He had meetings with the president, with the central bank, with several officials here and several companies here. And it was an amazing experience. The president was very, you know, adamant about being a global leader in terms of Bitcoin. And in the meantime, several scandals have come out. And one of which being that the presidential advisor that is supposed to advise him on this proposal is mining or has been mining Bitcoin since 2022 with subsidized energy. So it's been a little bit, a little bit rough here. But there is a payment commission that has been installed. So hopefully over the next couple of months, we'll have Bitcoin as legal tender, at least under this government. And either way, I'm running in the next election. So that is a little bit Samson's fault, too. He's the one that kind of pushed me over the edge.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, I think then a lot of people should probably be thanking Samson for giving you that push. I appreciate the background, and there's a number of things I want to dig into with that, because I think maybe a good starting point is, like you just mentioned, first of all, unbanked, the amount of the population that's unbanked, but presumably I think like the mobile phone penetration is actually quite high, like probably in the 80s, something like that. So it's
more than 80%.
So you have kind of this perfect storm of difficulty accessing banks, but hey, people have mobile phones or smartphones at the least feature phones, and that's fantastic. The other thing is just on the currency side. So the Surinamese dollar, I was just, you know, doing a little bit of prep for this, looking into it. And of course, I just start checking, okay, like Surinamese dollar and IMF and devaluations. And it's like, oh, wow, who could have thunk the IMF has suggested that there be several, you know, structural adjustments over the years to increase export competitiveness, as they say. And what does that really mean? Well, it means overnight you devalue by, I think there were a couple of like 20-30%, and then even larger ones more recently. And it's such a sad thing to see. Like you can, you know, you bring up the chart versus USD on Google, and it's like, okay, all of a sudden you have these drops off a cliff where you're like, oh, well, that's an IMF structural adjustment devaluation of the currency. Like that's just so sad to see. And so, I mean, maybe another good place to start though is just, you mentioned kind of corruption there. And I know I was, again, just Googling, like, let's see what the top things that come up in the news are about Suriname. And one of the more recent ones was, I think maybe from January or late December, about a president who was he was the leader, I think maybe dictator in like the 80s. And he was basically convicted of murdering political opponents, essentially. And now he's basically disappeared, but he was still like had a hand in the National Assembly. So corruption's interesting because obviously every country has corruption. Like it's not like there is any country whose hands are clean. The United States' hands certainly are not clean. Some countries are just better at hiding it than others, right? But I guess maybe just for those that are interested, and I know I am, can you give a little bit of a breakdown of like, how does the actual political system work there? I know the election's coming in 2025, right? Like basically a year from now. How does that political system work? You know, you have a National Assembly basically, and it's like kind of a parliamentary structure, but you know, what does that look like? And basically, you know, who do you have to kind of bring into your coalition, if anyone, to have a real fighting chance at this? Cause I'm guessing your opponents are probably, older gentlemen, and pretty entrenched in their old ways. So like, what does that strategy start to look like for you as you're going into this year leading up to the election?
Well, there's actually 2 points that I'd like to answer. So you mentioned IMF and then devaluation. But to clarify, the open market operations, the IMF told them that they needed to do them, but they didn't say what percentage. And from the central bank, they asked the commercial banks what they, you know, they did an auction, they held an auction, and the commercial banks decided what percentage. So they get 89 something percent after 6 months in SRD for the SRD that they take from the people and use to invest into these. So that's corruption at its core in the financial sector, with the central bank. You know, it's to me blatant money printing and just devaluing the currency without, you know, basically stating that you're doing that. And they've recently issued a new one at a lower percentage, but that one will come out right after the elections. So the timing of it is also very convenient. So you have systemic corruption in financial institutions happening that, you know, that has happened for a really long time. I think ever since we gained our independence in 1975. So the political sphere here, after our independence from the Netherlands in 1975, the dictator, Desi Bouterse, he actually was the one that held a coup and then took over he was basically ruling the country as a dictator. And at a certain point, people started gathering, teachers, doctors, physicians, journalists. So the educated people in the country were gathering. And he thought that they were planning a counter coup. So he had them dragged out of their houses, brought to the fort in the city of the country, and then after a day, I think it was, had them all shot in the back, or in the morning, had them all shot in the back. So this is something that happened in the 80s. And once that happened, I think about half of our population left and moved to the Netherlands. So we've had massive migration during that time. And then we've had pretty peaceful government, peaceful elections and government afterward. But there's just been systemic corruption at government. It's a lot of scandals back to back to back. If you just do a little bit of research in terms of just general corruption and on Suriname, you'll see a lot of scandals by government, mainly just. Almost it's become a career here to either work for government or kind of, you know, be a minister or be a member of parliament. And most often there is, some kind of kickback for arranging some kind of deal or things like that, that incentivize them to go for those roles. And I think it's mainly because we have a small economy, and we're very, off the radar, off the global radar, not in the international spotlight or anything. But that's going to change with the amount of offshore oil we found. In the last decades, we have massive offshore oil finds. So that political climate is going to change. So people are very tired of this old, these old politics and these old politicians. Because it was after the independence, it's been a shift constantly from either MPS, which is with the Green Party, and then you have NDP, the Purple Party, and then you have FEHAPE, the current government, the Orange Party, and they've also been based on race for a very long time. So each party would be, for a specific ethnic group. So that, created, actually separated people a lot and made them, vote against each other. In Dutch, we call it verdelen heerspolitiek, is you divide and conquer, basically. And each government has had their amount, massive amounts of corruption, and it's gotten really, really, really bad over the years, and it's gotten worse with every government. So this government, honestly, they don't give a fuck. And this is like senior advisors or people that who are independent from government but have been a CEO of the oil company or something. They're people that are aware of each government. And then they they themselves say this government really does not care. They haven't done anything in 3 years. It's been one scandal after the other. And my generation is just tired. And most people move away. We have a lot of doctors moving away. We have a lot of nurses moving away. We have teachers moving away. People looking for hope and prosperity somewhere else, right? So you're kind of just wondering, like, we need change right now. And 40% of voters are under 35, who we all know, you know, what the rest of the world is like. We can see it on our phones daily. So we know that things can be different. But when you get off the airplane here, it's like you're going back into time. I don't know, 40 years, 50 years. And the only reason why this country isn't developed or developing is because of its leadership. And just being a Bitcoiner, kind of coming into the space as Bitcoin only and being very, you know, in the toxic maxi atmosphere on Telegram, I grew up as a Bitcoiner with these beliefs, right? That there should be a free, fair, and open market. It should be transparent. Bitcoin fix the money, fix the world, basically. So if you change the money for the people and make it completely transparent, and like, for example, government spending can just be online, similar to how El Salvador shows its treasury, right? You can show where spending is going. And I feel a lot in this country politically has been, abused by government. So the state-owned companies, the government institutions, like, for example, our national air carrier has a massive amount of debt, over 100 million. And that's basically because of mismanagement, because government always, you know, in very nepotistically put certain people in the board of a company like that and then abuse their power. And also the government just has massive amounts of debt at these companies. So it's like they've just nested corruption at all the way to the core of the entire economy. And also at like the Minister of Finance, Ministry of Education, it's everywhere. And our healthcare has, like, they're currently protesting. Education teachers are protesting. Bank workers are protesting. The energy company, utility companies are protesting. Their staff, like, their staff are, the unions are currently protesting. So people are not happy with government. They want change. The other political parties really don't have a face yet. So they haven't announced who, you know, who is the what we call a ley strecker, like who's the person that will lead, you know, the race to the elections. And they haven't released their development plans either. And usually they don't have a development plan with an actual structured solution to the economy, aside from just stimulating certain sectors like production, for example. But that's just like you take what you see in an economy book and then, okay, copy paste and apply. That's not how you fix systemic problems, right? You need a broad overview and you need a broad strategy for the entire economy, not just based off where it is now, but where it could go. And, you know, we have with the offshore oil fines starting exploitation 2028, we'll have about 2.8 billion flowing into the country annually. And that can go into a sovereign wealth fund, but if it goes the same way that our oil resources have gone, like or our gold resources have gone, they will find out some or figure out some kind of structure to get a grip on those funds and misappropriate it. So if we want to actually develop this country and affect change, then we need new leadership and we need younger leadership. And there is a great group of technocrats that have zero political ambition or actually need it, you know, as a job or need the income from it, that are willing to work for this country and actually actively change it. And they are pro, you know, having Bitcoin be at the center of that because of its transparency and its properties, because I've been, you know, orange pilling them for a while too. So we're all collectively working. I've also had held presentations about Bitcoin and what it can mean for the country at other political parties as well. And my approach is very simple. It's, you know, we need to move away from racial segregation in politics in that way. We need to move away from party politics as well. It doesn't matter if you have left wing, right wing, upper wing, lower wing, you know, whatever kind of wing value. I think where we've reached a point globally with the global economy, with destabilization of the dollar, with technological advancement happening as rapidly as it is, we need to have a strategy for the country with, you know, all of that in mind, and on how we diversify away from, you know, things like fossil fuels, and how we transition into renewables, and how we develop this nation. We're the most forested country in the world, 93% forested, and we're about 8 times the size of El Salvador with a 600,000 people population. So we're very small. We have massive offshore oil finds. It's estimated more than Qatar. So we'll be a global leader in oil, which means we need to lay a foundation that can be, you know, the future for future generations here. And I believe taking what, you know, Bukele has done in El Salvador is beautiful, but it's still, I think, for him, a much bigger challenge than it is for us. I think with a smaller population, with a smaller footprint in the city, we can affect more change more rapidly than they have there. And we can actually lay the foundation for example, we have enough resources that we don't need to levy taxes. We have enough resources that we can actually, you know, have a form of universal basic income, like a royalty, for example, going directly to the citizens instead of being in some government pot. And then directly flowing to these people, you can use Liquid, for example, for that, right? So Bitcoin technology itself is at a point where we can actually implement it in this country and build it, that new system that you know, we all are in this for. Like when Satoshi started, it was the US system that was broken. But just if you just look at it at now, it's like, look at it now, it's like watching the Roman Empire crumble. It's hurt, it's painful to watch, but you can basically see the economy just spiraling out of control with the massive amounts of money that's being printed, but then also allocated towards war. So to me, it's you know, it's just, you see it inflating, and you know that it's going to have an effect on our economy as well. So we need to diversify away from the US as a you know, a unit of trade. And I honestly see no reason why we should maintain the SRD. It's inflated 50 to 60% annually. Previous governments have changed currency. And I think with the amount of resources we have, the structure that we've, that we're modeling, is basically that people will just be able to earn in Satoshis, and companies will just have their treasuries in sats. So you'll see your salary increasing in relation to every other fiat currency in the world. You'll see, you know, your treasury increasing, except for when it takes a 38% dive, of course, which happens every now and then. But I actually, Bitcoin saved my own companies, because when I saw what was going to happen with the economy and you know, COVID hit, I saw that it would be happening double. One, we were going to have massive inflation here, and two, the global economy was going to take a hit. So how do you hedge, right? How do you protect your company? So I converted everything to Bitcoin, and that is the only reason why we survived as long as we did. So I see it as a way for people to have a currency that is it's the payment layer of the internet. It is what the Web3 fluff industry will, you know, after this bubble bursts like it did, you know, in the 1990s, it will all move towards Bitcoin and Bitcoin development. So we want to be ahead of the curve and be a fostering, like a home for Bitcoin innovation, because we do want to innovate. So creating the right environment, legal frameworks, creating, you know, working on education to be able to educate our people to be developers, for example, on Lightning or Bitcoin Core. We all know we need more developers in this space. So that creates a job opportunity for our people. It's 600,000, of which not all 600,000 can work. You know, it's the working population is around 140,000. So it doesn't take much to actually diversify and affect change. It's a small economy, 2.8 billion. So attract that, you know, attract financial institutions or larger Bitcoin companies that can thrive here with what is missing currently globally is a clear regulatory framework, like clear guidelines, yes, you know, that don't limit privacy, that are not based on the old traditional financial system, but that encourage the growth of a new one, right? So we have that opportunity here. So we want to capitalize on that, make sure that, you know, our future generations have a future, especially with just what's happening in AI. It's crazy right now. So the educational system is already archaic. And we have a beautiful people here, like a beautiful diversity of cultures. You have Indians, Chinese, Dutch, some Americans, Australians. You have Javanese. You have Muslims and Jews. You have a synagogue next to a mosque here. So culturally, Maroons and Creoles in the city. So culturally, we're very diverse. We all eat each other's food. So we all go, you know, you have restaurants of every cuisine here, and we all go out and eat everything. We celebrate each other's holidays. So we have a lot of holidays, and we celebrate all of them together. So we're actually pretty peaceful people in general. Like, we've had like one protest, for example, and they set the parliamentary building on fire. But before that, every protest was peaceful. So in general, we're a peaceful people, pretty laid back, very traditional, very, you know, traditional culture. And I think things like that should be preserved, because I think the world is kind of going crazy at the moment. Yeah. It looks like, you know, sometimes you look at the news or you just see what's happening in mainstream media, and you're just like, is this really still happening? Are we not in 2024? Were we not supposed to have flying cars and you know, Star Wars type of shit? Where did we go so wrong that our leaders cannot even, you know, stop pretending?
Yeah.
Stop pretending and like just do what they need to be like doing for their people, like practice what they preach. It's weird to look at it from the outside. You know, we're just used to corruption here and used to it being this bad. But global wars escalating the way they're escalating right now, the amount of printing and subsidizing that is happening in the U.S., the economy basically, you know, on the verge of collapse, the real estate market on the verge of collapse, and it's like nothing is actually happening. And then when it's happened, then they'll have a narrative for it again. But it's like, haven't we seen this movie before?
It's deja vu constantly.
Yeah, it's crazy.
You know, so there's a lot there that I want to unpack. And you know, I was just thinking one thing that jumped out at me. You know, you mentioned this idea of, you know, okay, bringing in Bitcoin as legal tender, but also as the de facto tender, not just like alongside, like El Salvador, it's a dollarized economy, but we have Bitcoin as legal tender alongside that. What you're talking about is basically as it went from the Surinamese like Gilder or something, right? In the to the SDR.
Yeah.
And so you're talking about
SRD,
sorry. Yeah. And you're talking about another shift like that, basically, where you change now to Satoshis.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, you know, okay, like overall, you'll see purchasing power increase relative to all these fiat currencies, which is amazing. But yes, you do have these drawdowns. Yeah. But at the same time, I was thinking, you know, in a way, the people of Suriname are used to those drawdowns because they've had to have it enforced by the top from the top down through these devaluations.
Yes.
Like these are,
yes,
this is,
they've had worse. So, and you know, at the end of the day, one set will still be one set. So it holds true actually, you know, so their income will not lower because Bitcoin in relation to US dollar lost a percentage of value.
Right.
Right. So, the currency that they're saving in, like even the US dollar in inflates, is inflationary, and they currently save in euros or in euro euros or in USD. So it's for them, they're already saving in an inflationary currency and already losing value. So with Bitcoin, they'll immediately see that they're retaining value and actually saving.
Yeah.
Right, that's like, it's a better form of savings, because just imagine what their pension funds have done here. You know, and it's rough here.
Like, you know, volatility in Bitcoin is the price that we all pay for it actually being a fair system that cannot be corrupted from the top down, cannot be, you know, you can't just devalue Bitcoin and decide, you know what, we're just going to double the supply of this money. No, it's not how it works. And so I think it's a beautiful thing. You also mentioned, you know, okay, you guys are a fairly small population, 600,000, incredibly resource-rich country from your forests. You have, in terms of energy as well, hydroelectric. The oil deposits are, I mean, insane. Like that is earth-shattering amounts of oil that have been discovered. And that's something that for a population, especially that small, can have an incredible impact. And what I hear you saying, which is amazing, I wish somebody in U.S. government would ever say this, but get rid of taxes, because you,
yeah,
Suriname is a net producer economy. You are producing more than you consume. You have and you're able to export all this excess. And I think that's a beautiful thing, that a country like Suriname is kind of uniquely positioned with this flexibility to be able to say, look, we're small, but we are resource rich. Our people, there's no reason that they should be poor. There is absolutely no reason. And why are we extracting more of their hard-earned money when we're just devaluing it overnight anyway? So I think that that's a...
Exactly.
That's amazing. And maybe we could talk a little bit about the kind of the energy piece and how Bitcoin mining factors in there. Because obviously, okay, so you've got the oil. You have, I think... some pretty large hydroelectric facilities as well. And
so there's one,
yeah, go ahead.
There's one large hydro dam. About 180 megawatt capacity. There was an expansion plan for that hydro dam, but it's facing, you know, conservation issues. So that was never executed. Other than that, there's, you know, the fossil fuels, we have massive amounts of oil. And there is a proposal, actually a national commission that is currently negotiating 450 to 650 megawatt hydro dam that's been in planning for development for a while now, and is finally moving into where they actually want to tender for. So that we do have the potential for more hydropower, but I'd look towards more sustainable renewables and less harming the environment. But this is like, you have to do a feasibility study, or read the feasibility, the existing feasibility study, to see the pros and cons and actually weigh that, because you are laying a significant amount of forest underwater. And then we have the ability to have more solar power grids as well on the lake, as well as on the savanna, and for example, remote villages, because remote villages are too far away to be connected to the hydro dam or the grid anyway, so they need solar grids, and adding Bitcoin mining as a component to that allows us to create a larger grid where you use the excess for mining, and then as a community scales, you decrease the amount of mining. So our only hurdle, like the bottleneck with that is transportation. They're very far, like every village, rural village, is either only accessible by boat or by air.
Wow.
So that makes things a little bit difficult. But we're actually changing how we're looking at developing energy, because, you know, usually a country does not develop an excess of energy more than that its population would need over a specific time frame, right? With Bitcoin mining, we can actually incentivize the development of green energy plants with whatever technology is applicable at the given site. But basically, by adding Bitcoin, a Bitcoin mining component to it, that incentivizes that energy price. Right now, energy prices are very subsidized. The whole price calculation, recently we saw a presentation where the whole price calculation was done wrong and is actually supposed to be lower. So the people themselves are not the best buyer of energy as well. So you can actually push them more towards, for example, solar. In Suriname, all the houses are independent on their own little yard. So you can actually implement solar a lot easier in the city. So there's different ways that Bitcoin plays a role in this country. And over the last year, it's been crazy how many use cases you just run into, and people that reach out for here. For example, methane to energy. We have a dump site that has not been up to code since the 1970s, and that could be turned into an energy source, and that can actually create another source of income for the people as well if you add Bitcoin mining to it. So those are solutions we're looking at in the mining space. I think it's also important to just have the facilities for your own country so that you can mine your own Bitcoin and have that just be as a development strategy for the country. And decentralizing mining in general, in terms of geolocation.
I love it. And you mentioned just the methane from landfills, and I know I had Daniel Batten on this show a few episodes ago, and what they're doing is just incredible. And the fact that you can legitimately turn trash into treasure, i.e. Bitcoin, is amazing, while also reducing the harm that those landfills are doing to communities nearby. And I mean, you're generating revenue. And in this case, if you're doing it at a sovereign level, even better. I'm also curious, just in terms of other renewable sources, if you're thinking at all about OTEC, the ocean thermal, because I just also had Nate Harmon on. And he was mentioning that they may be working with some country in Latin America. Now I'm wondering, he said he couldn't say too much, so I won't push you either. But I mean, your Suriname is equatorial, like it's right by the equator there. So you are in literally one of the best possible places to do ocean thermal. So I was just wondering if that was also on your radar a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're actually having a meeting now. I'm missing that meeting
I'm really honored that you're on this one. But that's fantastic. So see, you're already two steps ahead. So I mean, this is the incredible thing. Like, Suriname is a small country. I've never been, but I really look forward to traveling there, hopefully someday soon. Energy rich, incredibly diverse population, and one that is probably, as you've said, from the political structure, often difficult to all get rallied behind a particular cause because of how divisive the politics are. How has the reception been, just either from people you've talked to or other folks in government, even if they're kind of on different sides, they're waving different colored flags, whatever. How has the reception been to these ideas in general? Because at a certain point, it gets really, like when you say, look, we're going to enable renewable build out in multiple ways, whether that be more hydroelectric, whether that be solar, whether that be OTEC, we have ways to be able to get rid of taxes for our people and to also just become more independent as a net producer nation going forward. I guess, how has the reception been, and are you getting Are you getting pushback from people? And what does that pushback look like, I guess? What's the biggest kind of hurdle to get over when you're talking about these ideas, which may sound crazy at first, but at like once you dig into them, it's like, oh, well, this, it seems too good to be true almost, but it is true. It can happen.
Yeah, well, it is. Here, it's mainly a positive reaction from almost all political parties. Also, because they've been hearing me speak about this for almost 6 years, and then now I've been on the media in the last couple of weeks about the Bitcoin mining site actually at the dam. So I've been in the media speaking about it actively, and I've held presentation at other political parties as well. And the conversations that we're having, you know, I'm very open. I'm very transparent. Like, I had no political ambition, and I swear to God, if I could do this, make it so that everything was automated on top of Bitcoin and just happens transparently, and I could just move on to something else, that would be the best possible outcome. You know, at a certain point, a country, I don't feel needs, you know, some one person to decide ultimately what happens in that country, even if you have a parliament. I don't feel like that is a necessity with the technology that we have. So that is the ultimate dream.
I mean, you know, that's kind of a radical thing to say these days. Like, I want to get to the point where I'm running for a position so that I can make changes that will make my position irrelevant. That's
exactly
that's kind of the
that
beautiful
is the dream.
Thing.
That is the dream. Yeah. So I've been very transparent in these conversations, and I've said we need to move away from what I said earlier, party politics, and you know, have a focus and a vision for developing this country. I need to collaborate. So we're lobbying for what we call in Dutch a Saka Kabinet, like a voluntary kind of just technocratic leadership that you put into place in certain position, and then just overhaul, restructure the system, and then, you know, in a year have everything live, everyone be able to live on just technology that's built on Bitcoin, and just be completely living on a Bitcoin standard, build a capital market that way, make sure that resource allocation is done properly, make sure that certain resources flow directly to the people and increase their purchasing power, compounded with the income that they already receive in Bitcoin in terms of other countries, right? Then we create a system of abundance for our population, and hopefully that can be a blueprint for the rest of the world. There's no reason why healthcare needs to be in the hands of government. I mean, you know, we've seen what has gone wrong in healthcare and with Big Pharma in the U.S. We're well aware of where how wrong it can go, but we also have examples globally of how it can be done right. So privatization does not have to be something specifically very bad for something like healthcare. Education doesn't have to be, you know, managed by government. It's completely gone to shit in this country. The same goes for infrastructure, public works, for example. There's still corruption happening right now. So if you do public tendering, if it's all trackable, traceable, if anyone in the population can immediately see, like, hey, that is where our resources are being spent for infrastructure, and they can actually decide for their own community. I'm a big fan of the Swiss cantonal model, where you just have voting, you know, happening at a cantonal level for that specific area. If a bridge needs to be built, if a road needs to be built, they basically vote on whether or not that will happen, whether certain policies are enforced. Like, for example, COVID policies weren't enforced in all cantons. So bringing the decision making back to the people where it's actually, you know, to whom it is actually relevant, giving them power over their natural resources, because those are right now just abused and then, you know, given to friends of politicians or used by politicians or by a very small handful of people that have power in this country. So it's very it's a very inefficient system. You know, it's not like the U.S. system where it is completely rigged And the global system, monetary system, that is completely outdated and only perpetrated, you know, in mainstream media by its proponents, like the institutions that depend on it to thrive and survive. I think in Suriname we can, you know, build a new model from the ground up where it does never create it, and make the system more efficient, but actually work for the majority instead of the minority. You know, even with real estate and investment, with a REIT, something that I've been working on for the last 2 years, and it's something that I actually just wanted to dedicate the rest of my life to and be my only and main focus, not politics. Thank you, Samson.
Then Samson
was,
came along.
Was real estate. Yeah. So it was just real estate and rethinking how, you know, because we're all Bitcoiners, but we still have a mortgage. And honestly, with the interest rates in this country and the hassle that it is at a bank to even be able to get a mortgage, like the average person can't do that here. So if you want to solve problems like that, you need to rethink how you purchase an asset, how you invest into a real estate. And we looked at the model, we looked at Blackstone, we looked at the banking system, and then we rethought the whole financial structure of a real estate investment trust and of traditional banking, and how would that work with, you know, Bitcoin at its core and on a Bitcoin standard or in a Bitcoin economy. And we looked at Singapore and how Singapore, in Singapore, it was the state that took on real estate and real estate investment and developed a trust. So if you look, kind of take that model, but make it work for the people, so for the majority, instead of just floating, you know, to 1%. And luckily, that is how a traditional REIT in itself is already structured. 90% of the profits have to go back to the shareholder. So if you're buying equity into a REIT, you're already, you know, increasing the amount of percentage you own. And by default, it flows back to the community. So even with that, we're thinking of something that can benefit the people, remove third parties like banks out of that equation, and can actually bring them directly to the investors that are putting up the money to fund the development or the purchase of a property like that. So it is, it allows for new innovation to happen, and I think we've reached a phase in just in the industry as well. I think we're moving away from just building things for just Bitcoiners and starting to build solutions that can actually scale for the rest of the population. I mean, I love the Bitcoin space and I love just being around toxic maxis. Like, it's, you know, you feel free finally, but just like the internet, not everybody gets how it works. Not everybody gets why there's HTTP or HTTPS, you know, on that link, on that URL on your browser. Not everybody knows that there are cables in the ocean that connect us. Like, you know, there are not that many people that actually understand how the internet works, but they use it every day. And I have the same thing here. I try to orange pill people. The community has grown from 3 people at a meetup to now more than 100. The response and outreach by political parties, by companies, by just people in general has been amazing. But still, it takes them a while to learn, you know, and understand exactly what Bitcoin is, because it is a lot. And even when you think you know, you realize you don't really know anything at all, right? And you just keep learning and keep learning and keep going deeper down that rabbit hole. So it's a journey for everyone. And I think if we keep requiring people or force people to learn how to do it our way, that we shut out a lot of the people that do want to use it but can't, right, or don't know how, and the learning curve is just too steep. And I love solutions that are very easy to use, like the NFC cards, you know, with Blink or whatever wallet integrates them. You make it easier for the people to just tap and pay, and you can make the amounts as small as possible so they can pay for anything. And just show them that here, for example, and their mind is blown. Like I've done some, you know, orange pilling here, and you show them like, here, I'll send you some stats, and they see how quickly it goes and their mind is blown. So I think stop trying to over explain. I mean, do explain, do educate, right? But show them more what it can do for them and what it can mean for them. And I think especially come the elections, you know, being able to have that type of transparency and have government completely transparent online is the complete opposite of what they're having right now. Like, this government has not reported, and there's the auditing institution of the country has stated that they cannot trust the government because they haven't released their annual reports yet, and certain divisions at ministries do not function that should be functioning in terms of auditing. So it will be completely the opposite of what they've had with this government, and it'll be an improvement in at least government spending. And if you privatize and automate away a lot of the bureaucracy that there is in these departments, because a lot of these ministries we don't even need, and just diversify the economy away from, mainly half of our population works for government at the moment. So we need to diversify them away from government, because every government hires about 9,000 to 10,000, sometimes 6,000 people. So every government just made that government machine a little bit too heavy. Like, there's not even enough work for the people that are working there to do. So upskilling, reskilling, and diversifying them, you know, creating other job opportunities for them in technology would be, I think, the best strategy for you know, the next at least 5 years to focus on, to get us where we need to be in 2030.
You know, this is such a radically refreshing thing to hear from some. I feel bad even calling you a politician, because I think it has this almost like dirty connotation these days, like, oh, they're a politician. Like, it seems almost unfair to call you that, because what you're suggesting is a complete rethinking of how the modern state should function, and a kind of a radical transparency from what it sounds like, really like minimalism when it comes to actual state apparatus size. And it's just honestly incredibly refreshing to hear something like that. I do have to wonder, given the number of people that work for the state bureaucracy in Suriname, do you foresee a good amount of pushback when it comes to, like, if you're running on a platform of, I want to minimize the state, I have to imagine there's going to be a good amount of pushback against that. But I would hope that at the same time, what you're proposing as, look, I'm not trying to take away your job, I'm trying to put you in a position to get a job that is actually productive, actually producing value versus more extractionary. If you live in a country where the government is only ever increasing in size, like I do, you want to make sure you keep your Bitcoin safe from their old, wrinkly, greedy, kleptocratic hands. So, head to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code WALKER for 5% off the fully open source, Bitcoin-only, Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. Then get your Bitcoin off the exchange and into your own custody. The Bitbox O2 is easy as hell to use, whether you are brand new to Bitcoin and it's your first hardware wallet, or you're a seasoned psychopath and you've got a couple dozen. Again, it is Bitcoin only. And again, it is fully open source. You can head to their GitHub and verify that for yourself. There is no need to trust me. Plus, when you go to bitbox.swiss/walker, and use the promo code WALKER, not only do you get 5% off, but you also help support this fucking podcast. So thank you.
Great. Yeah, well, we've actually ran the calculations, and with the existing resources that we have now, royalties from our national resources, the government is actually just funneling money to these people. So you can actually transition them away from government, set a specific period of time that these resources will be directly channeled towards them, and then just have like a period of reskilling, like teaching them, you know, other job skills, or finding other industries for them to be able to work in, which is why we focus on finance and technology, because that is where you can actually place 40 to 60,000 people in a span of two to three years, re-educate them and have them go into other move into other industries. So that's how we were looking to solve this problem even before we receive royalties from offshore oil. So just thinking about, okay, how can we solve this major problem, right? Now, with the finances that the country has now, that the people have now. And it is actually, the solution is removing government from that equation. Just give them the resources directly. It actually increases their purchasing power because now they have more to spend, right? And if the government like actually still needs to, let's say in a transitory period, in a transition period, have to, for example, build roads or raise capital to be able to finance that can be done in the Bitcoin bond, something that Samson himself has worked on in the past. So there are ways to transition, you know, completely to Bitcoin, but we will be earning enough in fiat to actually cover a universal basic income, which is also for some reason has become a dirty word. But that is because it would be coming from taxes. But if we don't charge taxes, it's not coming from our taxes, it's coming directly from our resources. And a proportion of which, you know, it's just a percentage of which will be going to these people. And then hopefully over time, similar to what has happened in Switzerland, when the people, their standard of living is well enough, when they earn well enough, when the country's economy is doing well enough and growing, then they themselves will not have a need and vote against receiving that UBI, favoring it going towards, you know, the development for future generations, creating wealth for other generations that will come after them. Because we as a species, we're only limited to think, you know, to what is close to us, our direct line of, you know, children, grandchildren, but you don't look forward past certain amount, like certain generations anymore. But in Switzerland, they have had that, happen. Voting against UBI. So we do think that if you create the infrastructure, the climate for people to thrive, we develop, you know, a technology innovation free zone where Bitcoin companies can thrive and develop and test their products without the fear of constantly being, you know, being hammered or slammed by government or financial authorities in their country, because we were working towards actually being a breeding ground for development that creates jobs, right, for locals and other sectors that they can diversify into that would have never existed before. So we create this funnel and whirlwind, hopefully similar to what El Salvador also has had, an increase in tourism, increase in talent moving there, attracting foreign capital and talent. I mean, there's no lack of US dollars in the world. There's enough that has been printed in the last 3 years. So we should be able to attract some decent, significant investment into the countries, specifically because we'll be doing multiples in real estate. If you look at Guyana next door, you can kind of predict what our country is going to do in terms of GDP growth, right? They did during COVID years, 40% during years where other countries were doing negative GDP growth. They were doing 48% year over year. So they've also built, are building a significant sovereign wealth fund similar to what we'll be doing starting in 2028. So the future is bright. We just need to have a strategy on how we can change and adapt it. And I think more than, you know, strengthening what El Salvador has already started, but taking it one step further and also like making the not just the use case, but showing actually that Bitcoin as a replacement for a central bank system, for a debt-based system that actually can work, I think that will be you know, that is when we win, right? We've gone through all the stages. Now we're in the they fight us stage, or actually, if they can't beat them, join them phase. It looks like more, but it looks like we're in those final stages, at least with regulators. But I think this is one of the catalysts that could help push us over the edge, where you actually have a proof of concept, like it actually works. You don't need a debt-based system. You can have transparency. You can have an ethical government, or you can have a government that is actually like it does what it's meant to do, without manipulating or rigging the system to benefit it, you know, a certain amount of its members. But that it actually works for the people. And that is actually of this age. So we can, as a region, you know, as Latin America, as a continent, can start focusing on regional development, you know, developing roads from each country to the other, improving trade. I think Bukele also spoke about this, improving trade in between these countries, because we don't even have roads that connect us. We don't have trains that connect us. Like, if you want to go from the Netherlands to Spain with a train, you can. If you want to do that here, you can't. You can be in one country or the other in a couple of hours without needing to make some kind of weird layover somewhere. So, it doesn't really make sense. We're not very collaborative amongst each other. So we need to make a shift into a strategy that is not the same as what the West has been preaching or pretending to preach. Right, it's basically just focused on issues of the moment, issues at hand, but nothing really proposing a different dynamic than what has already been. So I feel like we as a continent, we have twice the population of the US. We have a diversity of resources and culture and rainforest. We are the lungs of the world right now. So that we should be in a position to have a seat at the global table and the global conversation, and be able to, you know, create a vision for the development of our continent without the interference or influence of just US companies or European companies that tell us what or how we need to do it. It's mainly the Googles coming in here and, you know, building a headquarters, and basically that is what the future will be. Starlink, distributes satellites all over the world. That is the internet that we'll be using. We don't even have a seat or companies that can compete at that level, because most of the resources of our nations have been flowing to those to develop them. So I believe it's time for the entire continent to change, and hopefully the rest of the world can then, I'm assuming this will take about a decade, the rest of the world can follow suit, and then we can move from being a species that constantly needs to fight war to one that can, like, I don't know, can we live like Trekkies? Am I allowed to say that?
No, you know what I love is that when you're describing these plans, it's very obvious that you're not thinking in like 4 or 5 year election cycles. Like in the US we have 4 year cycles, and all plans are typically measured in those 4 year cycles, because politicians know they've got to promise something before the election. Then they've got 4 years to blame the other party for why they weren't able to actually accomplish what they wanted to do. And then when they run again, they get to reuse the same thing for the next election to say, but this time I'm going to get it done. And over and over ad nauseum. But the way that you're talking about your plans, you're talking in decades. Like you're talking about in generations, not just, okay, what am I going to do to get elected? But no. You're already thinking about second and third order effects of, okay, yeah, like UBI, a very contentious issue, no doubt, because usually the way it's proposed by people in the US or in Canada, for example, or in the EU, it's going to be funded by a combination of printing fiat and taxes, with just enough taxes enough taxing the rich happening that they can cover over the money printing that's actually funding it. But it's always just it's a short-term band-aid. They say, well, the cost of living is so high, we should give everyone UBI, and that'll fix it. But of course, that's only going to exacerbate the cost of living because they're doing it via fiat printing. What you're suggesting is we have abundant resources. We are a net producer, so we can give those dividends back to our people without needing to print fiat to do so. And I think that's a really fundamental difference in UBI approaches for anyone, but for Bitcoiners especially, who hear UBI and think, what is this socialist crap? Like, that a country that is productive and is not just extracting resources from its population and then devaluing their savings through fiat printing should be able to give dividends back to its people. Like, it should be run like a well-oiled machine, like a state corporation. And, you know, I'm not suggesting fascism here to anyone listening, just to clarify, you know, but I think that it's a nice thing to hear somebody talk about plans in terms of generations. And I think that it's very difficult for a lot of folks in political power right now, whether that be in Suriname, where you have people, you know, in their 60s or 70s who are in power, or in the U.S., where our presidential candidates are all like 80 years old. Like, how can they possibly think long term when their lives are almost over? Like, it's not realistic. They're trying to see how much they can grab before they kick the bucket. And, you know, that's about as far as they think. And so I just want to say it's very cool to hear this. And I think, can you maybe elaborate a little bit more on what your kind of, what your model for the state is in this modern era? Because what you're proposing is, again, I think to someone like me, like, this sounds amazing. You're talking about decreasing the state's role, but you're also talking about the state being able to provide very basic functions that are net benefits for its people, as opposed to many of the things the states do now across the world, which are, I think, net negatives. Can you elaborate a little bit more on, like, more generally what you think the role of the modern state should be in this kind of technological great reset and monetary reset that we're in the midst of? What do you think is the role of the state? What should it actually do for its people? What is the point of it?
Well, developing the economy, for one, that is, you know, a part of its, well, actually should more be a facilitatory role by government, you know, enabling the private sector to thrive and the economy to grow, but not actually controlling it. And in a similar trend, a development plan for the country itself, right? There are certain sectors that correspond to each other or need to be developed, or certain sectors that need government guidance, like energy, for example. Energy you can privatize, but the government still has to make sure that the legal policies and like the legal frameworks are in place to protect consumers. So I think we need to find a balance between policy and regulation that actually enables, you know, energy to develop and thrive, and for that sector to grow without it harming consumers. So the role of government in that case would actually be more of a transition for it to be privatized, but with the right policies in place to protect consumers from, you know, just bad actors in that sector. So it would be more of a, I think, facilitative role. And then in sectors like or ministries like education, natural resources, for example, those are things where the government has a negotiating power. But there's no reason why that doesn't have to happen transparently, right? Why do oil contracts, gold contracts, resources that are owned by the entire population, why do they have to be held in closed rooms and have to be, you know, negotiated by one single commission that's representing the government that the people have not elected, for example. So there are certain things where government has to still play a role that can hopefully be automated away later. But that there are things that where, you know, from a policy perspective, from an administrative perspective, you're still going to need some physical form of government that can represent the people. But I see no reason why that couldn't happen in the public eye, right? If you increase transparency over, for example, utility companies, their financing, then there is no reason why that cannot, you know, work to the benefit of the people. And I think specifically because our country is so small, private sector is fairly small as well. Our GDP is 3.2 billion. So you can actually enable that private sector to thrive off of, for example, just the oil income without any government influence whatsoever. So I really believe that we should decrease government overreach and move in, and this, you know, it differs per specific ministry, because education will need a completely different overhaul than for example, healthcare. Healthcare is not automated at the moment. There are systems that can automate healthcare, and hospitals are state-owned, but they don't even have basic medical supplies right now. Like, you can't get an IV bag. You need, there are no beds available in one of the hospitals. So it's a dire situation at the moment. And private hospitals can, for example, become very commercial and bad, like in the US where it's become, you know, like the margins are just insane that they charge for example, insulin. And just when you go to the hospital, for example, the bill you get, that is your savings sometimes, right? Or more than your savings. Sometimes you need to remortgage your house just to be able to afford your medical expenses. So to avoid something like that, for example, happening here, because the cost of healthcare is fairly low, and there's no reason for it to be sky high, but there's no reason for it to be bad either. Like, you can, you know, you can improve in sectors like that. Same goes for healthcare. But there's no need for government involvement in that either. Something as our natural resources. Right now, you have a lot of natural resources that have been given to, you know, the vice president or to their family members, and those are mining gold that is actually belongs to the population of this country. So restructuring that sector, specifically the gold sector, that would create a lot, like a direct source of income that would increase, like it would immediately create more wealth for the entire population if it's not just in the hand of a corrupt few. But then you'd need systems also, you know, to make sure that that it actually is going to the population. But I see, again, no reason why that can't happen transparently and publicly. If you're not planning on doing any corruption, nobody on our team is incentivized to, you know, need some kind of, I don't know, additional income coming from this, because honestly, we do well enough as entrepreneurs on our own, and we, you know, we can probably earn more than you would in SRD. I think a minister right now makes, I think, 1200 US if you convert it to US dollars. So it's not, you know, we're not incentivized. That is not why we're doing this. We have a love of this country. We still like to see it develop. We have hope in its future. And we see how bad it is right now. Everybody on the team is fighting against, you know, corruption at some point, and has been in the media at some point about corruption. So we want to see change, and I think we're all very innovative. We're, you know, technocrats. We prefer to see solutions that use just the latest technology. Like, what is the use of all of this inefficiency and bureaucracy? And I think by that we're also improving our own lives, and by extension, everybody else is in the country. But I think primarily it's also what just annoys us as, you know, a younger generation that grew up on both not having computers, but then, you know, I was 3 years old playing around with, you know, assembling a PC back then, and grew up on DOS. so we're a generation that has experienced both, right? So we want the efficiency that the internet has to offer, but we do want like a bit more structure and transparency in it as well. I think we've just reached an inflection point in this country, and I think just world and society as a whole, and it just feels like everything up till now, and even like this last 6 years or this last decade, like everything has been, you know, a decade of work that is now coming into play and kind finally, you know, coming into execution. And it's just like everything is falling into place. Even other political parties, even, you know, influential people here in the country, even just the amount of support that I'm receiving, it's just, it's crazy how everything is just kind of like kismet happening, because it should.
Right time, right place, right people, right ideas, right technology. Kind of a beautiful confluence coming together. Exactly. No, I love that. And I'm curious, you have gone through so much incredible stuff here, and the plans that you have are really inspiring and actionable. But also at the same time may seem complex, or like, you know, so many of the things involving Bitcoin, it's like, it seems almost too good to be true, but it is true. But what is your like condensed, you know, elevator pitch version of, to, you know, the people of Suriname for, okay, here's why, you know, here's what we can actually do for you as a people. Here's what we can do for this country. Here's the change we can make. What is that kind of condensed version that is understandable to anyone? What does that look like?
Well, I would say, one, ending inflation. That is something that they can directly and immediately relate to, because that is something that they have been feeling for decades. Ending corruption, creating more transparency, creating a way for them to immediately see where, you know, where our natural resources are being spent and how government spending is happening and where it's going to. Improving and modernizing healthcare, education, creating better systems, because they've been systemically abused by government after government. And that is just because of the centralization of power, right? So decentralization of power and giving the power back to the people, I think that is something that we can actually achieve here with an actionable strategy. If we collaborate, if we work together, you know, I mean, there are enough people and great, the best minds in the world actually in this space, and more are joining. So I think if we just join forces, if everybody just collaborates, that we can, you know, actually achieve that domino effect. We can actually have, you know, more countries adopting Bitcoin and actually have, you know, it spreading once you see that it's successful, because you can see how it started in El Salvador, how it's doing. Then you have Suriname next, then you have we already have, you know, some other countries that are also looking at it, countries that are just buying it, countries that are investing or diversifying more into mining. So it's already spreading, but it will just be a more rapid, way to actually show that government, the state, doesn't have to be the way it is right now, that the world doesn't have to be the way that it is right now, and that we shift away from, I feel like the world is in kind of like a whirlwind at the moment, or the whirlpool, like just kind of spiraling and spiraling and spiraling down. And we just need to have like one little boat that, you know, figures out a way to get up, and then the rest will follow. So I that is what I envision for this country. And what I hope that, you know, I can help build for my kids and my grandkids. A future that I would be proud of to bring kids into this world. So, that's what I'm dedicating the rest of my life towards. And I hope that, you know, this generation in Suriname understands that we have a unique opportunity to be a global leader and be a force for change in the world and be, you know, we can change this country and change the economy, and we can build a country where, you know, even people that have moved away would want to come back to, similar to what's happening in El Salvador. Again, I'll use that example where it's just proof that it works. If there is hope, if there is prosperity, if you believe that you have a future and that your leader has your country's best interest at heart and your best interest at heart, that you can you know, build a future there, and that you want to live in that country, and that hopefully in a couple of years I'll be redundant and we can have a different form of a country or how a country interacts with its institutions, because I don't think we need to be governed, right? We're not sheep, or at least I hope we're no longer sheep.
I love that, and it's a great message, and I love the idea. I mean, I had the pleasure of going to El Salvador a couple of times in 2022. Ended up going back the same year for Adopting Bitcoin. Went there just for a vacation on a whim to see what it was all about, and then was back a couple months later and just loved it, and loved the genuine hope and excitement for the future that people had, that you could genuinely feel that it was palpable. And of course, not every, you know, you truly cannot please everyone all the time. There are always going to be people that are detractors, that are not happy with something. But what I saw was that the vast majority of people were happy and did have hope. And as you said, people are going back. People who left El Salvador long time ago are now coming back because they have hope again. That to me is one of the strongest indications you have when expatriates come back and repatriate again. That means that they see a chance for their homeland to thrive. And that's a powerful thing. And I think, you know, these countries like El Salvador, like Suriname, that are small enough where perhaps a lot of the world forgot about them for a while, or the only times that they would be appearing in the Western press was for corruption or gang violence, like in El Salvador, only negative things. Now you're seeing that narrative shift, and in a really positive direction, and shift quickly. And I think that's kind of the beautiful thing, is that it's like this entrenched corruption or entrenched violence, it can be around for truly decades, for generations, but it just takes one generation of leaders and of people who are willing to, you know, to take a step out of it. Like you said, you know, to steer their boat out of that vortex of doom. It just takes that one generation to be able to make really powerful changes that then set up the future generations to actually have a homeland that is one they can really be proud of. And so I think I absolutely love what you're doing. I wish you nothing but success. I don't think you need luck. It seems that you've got a lot else going for you. But I am curious, and for anyone listening to this, if there are Bitcoiners who say, I love what Maya's doing, I want to somehow help, I'm not from Suriname, but like, what is the best way that Bitcoiners or anyone listening can support your efforts, can try and make a difference? You know, are there grassroots initiatives in Suriname that they can donate to, or that they can volunteer for, or come visit? Or what's the best way for people to be able to make some sort of contribution, monetary or otherwise?
Well, there's a lot of grassroots adoption and projects that are rolling off the ground. So in education, there's a soccer academy that recently launched a federation, and they need funding to keep the program going and scale it throughout the country. Right now it's 1,300 families, and he's funding it out of his own savings, and he's been doing that for a year. So he needs support in funding. They're on Geyser, so that would be a good project to support.
What's it called?
Nova Stars. Okay.
And that's a
Nova Stars, it's a Fediment? Soccer academy.
That's awesome.
Yes.
That's really cool.
Fediment, yeah. And we have other grassroots projects that could use help, you know, in terms of education. We the soccer academy also wants to teach the kids skills, so development skills. So that is somewhere where we need help. But I'd say just join the Bitcoin Sranang Telegram group, and then basically offer to explain what you can do, because that is also something, people come into the group and say that they want to help, but we don't know where we could actually use their help. So just hop into the Telegram group, and there's, Surinamese already in there, Bitcoiners from the Bitcoin community here already in there. So just offer your help and move here.
That's another good option.
We need more people on the ground too. And actually people are moving here. So start off in Telegram if you can, but visit if you can.
I think Carl and I will have to take you up on the visit. Bring the little one with us too.
Awesome. I'd love to host you guys.
I'll drop the links for their Geyser, and then also for this Telegram group. I'll drop that in the show notes as well. And for folks who want to connect with you, Nostr, Twitter, I'll drop them in there. Anywhere else they should go, or you want to send people?
Yeah. It's mainly Nostr. I respond later on X, but that's usually the way to go.
Fantastic. I will. I'll link that at the top. But Maya, thank you so much for sharing your scarce time. This was really fascinating, and I love what you are doing. I love learning about it. And I hope that this inspires other Bitcoiners as well. That, I think one of the most amazing things here is that this is not something you were seeking. You weren't saying, I want to be a politician. I want to hold this political office. We can blame Samson for this, but, I think those are the best people, and the people that should actually be in leadership roles. And when it comes to whatever government we have, are the ones that don't want it. Because the ones that do want it and want it way too much generally don't have the best intentions. And I think we see that across the world. But really appreciate your time. This was fantastic. And I look forward to seeing you win this thing. I hope I will be able to say, I got a chance to interview the next president of Suriname, because that'd be quite an honor.
Great. Thank you for having me. Welcome.
I'm going to cut this recording right here. And that's a wrap on this Bitcoin Talk episode of the Bitcoin Podcast. If you are a Bitcoin-only company interested in sponsoring another fucking Bitcoin podcast, head to bitcoinpodcast.net/sponsor. If you're enjoying the Bitcoin Podcast, consider giving a 5-star review wherever you listen, or sharing this show with your network. Or don't, Bitcoin doesn't care. You can find me on Nostr by going to primal.net/walker. And if you want to follow the Bitcoin Podcast on Twitter, go to @titcoinpodcast and @walkeramerica. You can also find the video version of this podcast at youtube.com/@walkeramerica and @walkeramerica on Rumble. Bitcoin is scarce. There will only ever be 21 million, but Bitcoin podcasts are abundant. So thank you for spending your scarce time to listen to another fucking Bitcoin podcast. Until next time, stay free.